Hello and welcome to a special edition of Money Matters. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Bob Carey, who we listen to a lot in the industry. You may not, it's not exactly a CNBC household name, but First Trust is a very well known within the industry for having market thought, economic thought, and if you will, a difference of opinion. Bob Carey has been part of that company for 28 years. As he likes to say it, it's a very it's probably the quietest 100 plus billion dollar company out there on Wall Street. And that would be really not in our industry are they quiet, because they're the ones that stand out. And I don't want to be too complimentary here, because we're going to have some good questions coming up here. But Bob, you guys have nailed this thing. I just can't believe. We'll get into some of the recent things with interest rates that maybe you guys haven't nailed. But what is it basically that has helped you all see this as a very bullish run? You've stayed bullish as a company. You've just continued to talk about stocks being undervalued, and you've been right when everybody else is calling for, you know, it's a sugar high or, you know, whatever. I sometimes think that's a political statement. That's an aside. But you guys have nailed it. What is different, and how are you seeing the world differently that has given you that perspective?
Yeah, Dave, that's a great question. I think ultimately the source of really what grows the economy over time is, we just look at things differently. We look at, you know, basically how is it that we do what we do today economically compared to maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago? So we tend to look at the increasing supply of basically businesses and productivity as our main source of growth in the economy over time. We don't really see demand so much as the way things grow. So we look at the entrepreneur, we look at tax policy, we look at the regulatory policies, and ultimately the ever-increasing supply of new products and new services in the economy, we think long-term, is what drives the economy. And most discussions on Wall Street focus almost exclusively on demand. You know, where's demand going to come from, blah, blah, blah. And the reality is there are so many things that we buy today and so many different things that businesses do that we weren't demanding. It's just that the entrepreneurs and the engineers and the software people came up with new ways of doing things. And I think that is really the main reason we take a different view on things. Interest rates, you know, are important. Those are certainly, you know, forecasting the market, the economy, interest rates, all that. We certainly do that, but it's always through the lens of, you know, what is ultimately driving the economic activity that we see forward. And that's really the big focus of our firm.
So it's a longer term focus, is if we were going to put it in a nutshell, rather than the day to day trading.
Yeah, exactly. It's looking at, you know, basically how do we look as an economy? What are the products and services that we provide? What are, you know, how have things changed? And things have changed tremendously here in the last 10 years. And I think that's really been the source of our bullishness, is that we've just become ever more productive in the economy.
You know, I appreciate that kind of approach. One of the things that we've been talking about, if you will, we kind of have a little segment here that I call, you know, what I've been thinking about. And I hope that you can maybe jump on this a little bit. So over the past couple of weeks, and again, to take it down to a microcosm of time, we have heard as the market's sinking and had a very difficult May, off whatever, 7% or something like that. And in trade, it's all about trade. It's all about trade. It's all about trade. And then we decide 2 weeks ago to go ahead and amp that up, or 10 days ago or so, we're going to go ahead and go to trade war now with Mexico.
Right.
And then the market explodes 6% higher. But now, oh, no, excuse me, shiny object market. Let's run over here. Oh, it's interest rates now. It's not trade. No, it's interest rates. And so I shake my head, and we're all like on the same page. Oh, it's interest rates now. And as if the trade was the issue 7 days ago is not even on the roadmap, because we just made it worse, not better. And then now we're always putting our finger up and trying to figure out why. And I just don't understand that kind of a short-term thought process.
Yeah, it's meant to attract viewers. It's meant to attract, basically listeners and viewers. And it's all, like you say, it's a shiny object. And you know, ultimately the market is going to have its fluctuations, and it seems like we are always searching for meaning. And I got one of those calls. I had a reporter call me in December, and the market was going down, and you know, this guy really wanted to know why the market was going down. And what I wanted to say was we just simply had more sellers than buyers. And what motivates people to take action is really, to me, not the most important thing. It's really about having a framework of basically where all of these businesses that that have chosen to list their stock publicly, ultimately, what are the decisions made by those companies, and how does it affect their economic performance? And that is, like you say, it's a longer-term sort of thing. And it, you know, I think ultimately the short-term can distract you from the long-term and distract you from your goals, ultimately, as an investor, as a saver. I think all those things, I'm sure you struggle with that with your clients. People want to know, why is the market, you know, why the market's down right now? It was up this morning. And it's from a, you know, 5 years from now, even 5 days from now, and nobody really cares. And shouldn't care all that much. And sometimes we even argue about what caused the market to do what it does. I got my start in the industry in the mid-1980s. I watched the market crash in 87. And there are PhD dissertations that are still trying to figure out, well, really, what caused that crash? And we all know the reason. We just simply had more sellers than buyers in the very short term. But it's not really that important from a long-term perspective. And you know, kind of looking through all that is really what we're all about. Looking at things more strategically instead of tactically, I think, is the most important thing.
It's tough to do. I mean, obviously, you're in kind of a, what do you want to say, a witchcraft type of industry, right? We try to predict the future, and most people are incredibly bad at it. You guys seem to do pretty well, and by keeping your eye more on a long-term ball, which is pretty clear, and we've talked about. But as far as any kind of a short-term type of thing, do you... The machines control, what, 80% of our trading, something, some number like that. Does fundamental thought, as if that becomes 85% or 90%, or do we just trust the machines have fundamental thought rather than just trading off of some soundbite or whatever algorithm they're trading off of? Does that trouble you?
Yeah, well, the fact is algorithms have been around for a long time, and the algorithms are, in fact, programmed by people. And what tends to happen with every investment strategy is that if the programs have bad inputs, eventually those programs are not going to be profitable for those people. And I think, you know, thinking back to December, we had an awful lot of program trading kicking in. The yield curve inverted, and you have all these programs that kick in and they start selling. And we take a step back and we look at, well, was that a good strategy? And the fact is it wasn't. A lot of folks ended up getting blown out of the market back in December. And I think what tends to happen is these machines look at history and they trade off of correlations. And correlation is not always causation. And correlations change over time as well. So I think ultimately it always gets back to fundamentals. How are the companies doing that make up the market, how are they doing at making investments? And that, to me, is the most important thing of all. Companies generate cash flow from their investments, and all we are is we're just trying to figure out whether or not those investments, in fact, are profitable and sustainable. And that's and in the end, if you can look at things through that lens and have a framework and have a model that looks at things from a long-term perspective, then these short-term fluctuations, they come and go. There's all kinds of algorithms and strategies and hedge funds that have been around forever, and I've seen a lot of them go by the wayside. They can be very successful from a short-term perspective, but if they're not sustainable, then investors are not going to allocate more capital to those strategies that just simply are not going to work over time.
You know, you've been doing this for a long time. I have too. And one of the things that surprises me is that people don't seem to learn. If anything, we're trading more when that strategy is proven to be wrong. And I'm not talking about day traders or whatever, they're professionals. That's a minority. But people, right, the short duration of, like, you know, I like Google now. I don't like it now. I should buy Apple. And yet we watch decade after decade that buying Apple and owning it, instead of worrying about how many quarterly sales of an iPhone there were, or iPods, or they're losing market share in Taiwan or whatever it is that they fixate on and blow people out of positions, is how people create fortunes. And this happens decade after decade,
right,
generation after generation. And we don't learn this. And we're getting worse at it as theoretically smarter we are. What, if you agree with that statement, if you don't agree, that's great. But if you do, what do we do about that?
Well, I think one thing that's changed is that the cost of transacting has gone down tremendously over our careers. You think about how expensive it was to buy 100 shares of a $40 stock 30 years ago. There was a fixed rate. The percentage was high enough that you probably looked at that as a long-term investment. Okay, I'm going to pay a commission. Increasingly, a lot of people don't even pay commissions or pay minimal commissions on their trades. And so it generates, to me, a mindset among some people that, well, there's really not, I don't really have that penalty if I look at things from a short-term perspective. And I think that's played a significant role in our industry here in the last 10 to 15, 20 years. As trading costs have gone down, investors have, in some cases, traded more. But I think more than anything else, we have gone through a cycle since 2009 that is very different than previous market cycles. One of the points that I've been making in all of my presentations over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and I'm still doing it, is that the public in this cycle has been much more concerned about finding yield than they have about generating total returns off of their investments. We see at the margin the vast majority of dollars actually have gone into bond funds and income-related investment vehicles. Normally in a bull market, as the market goes up and up and up and up, the public tends to get more and more bullish, and hence they tend to put more money into the market. We had, essentially last month, we had the biggest deviation between inflows between bond funds and stock funds that we have seen in this cycle. And investors have essentially been paying a very, very high price for safety this cycle, as opposed to focusing on generating returns on their portfolios. This is a very different market than, for example, the late 90s, when investors basically didn't want to buy bonds. They wanted nothing to do with the income markets. They wanted to buy the latest .com IPO or the latest biotech IPO. It was a very different sort of cycle than we see today. So we're selling at about 17 times earnings today. Back in the late 90s, the S&P was selling at over 30 times earnings. And we have investors buying the 10-year Treasury at 2%, thinking it's going to go to 1.5%, which it may, but effectively a 2% yield on that 10-year Treasury is the same as paying 50 times earnings. So the benchmark that we use in the bond market is at 50 times earnings. The benchmark that we tend to use in the stock market, the S&P, is selling at 17 times earnings. So we've got an enormous gap in valuation between what investors are paying for in the income markets compared to what they're paying for earnings and equities. So you're getting paid to take risk right now that is unusually high at this point in a market cycle.
So the risk premium is off the charts, if that's fair to say.
Exactly. And that's a great way to look at it.
In fact, I can't think of a time it's been this high. I mean, literally this high. In a world of great abundance, again, it just seems counterintuitive.
Yes.
Of massive wealth being created in the, is this political noise? Is it a media that's screaming for attention, that's dying its final breath of relevance? What do you think it is that causes people to have such scars from 2008? They can't see that the sky really is blue. They can't see it at all.
I do think politics has played a significant role. I think, thinking back to the last decade, the argument that I heard from a lot of people was, well, I can't take any risk in my portfolio because of the policies of President Obama. And now I'm hearing just the opposite. Well, I can't take risk because of Donald Trump. And it's amazing to me. The economy is you know, we have a $20 trillion economy here domestically. We have another $40 to maybe $50 trillion of economic activity outside the U.S. The federal government is a big machine. There's no question about it. It taxes a lot. It spends a lot. But the size of government relative to the size of the private sector is closer to 25%. I'm much more focused on the other 75% that I can actually invest in. And I think for a lot of people, they spend a lot of time focusing on politics. And it's very hard to make the argument that the public is engaging in more consumption of the media. In fact, I agree with your assertion that I think more and more people really don't pay a whole lot of attention to the media. We no longer have three channels, and we've got the 5 o'clock news, and we all pay attention to that. It's a different world that we live today. It's much more continuous. There are so many more channels and sources, and everything is through the lens of politics. I'm literally staring at my Bloomberg, and everything the market has done in the last 24 hours is being attributed to politics. And politics are important, but they're not the only thing. And I think a lot of folks that are sitting on the sidelines looking at this going, well, it's all because of politics that either good things or bad things happen. And I would argue that it's not the case. It's much more up to the scientists, the engineers, the entrepreneurs. They're the ones that are driving this thing long term. And if you focus on politics, you miss out on all the things that are happening in the economy that we can actually invest in.
And actually as a driver, right? Government isn't the driver, but that 25% has grown from around 20.
No question about it.
If I could wave a magic wand, we'd go back below 20, and then we'd see the private sector growing from 75% to over 80%, and we would see a boom we haven't seen in decades.
That's very, very true, which is exactly what happened in the second half of the 90s. You know, by the way, it happened under a Democratic presidency and Bill Clinton. It's he came out in his State of the Union address in 1995 and said the era of big government is over. And, you know, at least for 5 or 6 years, that was true. But things changed in the early part of the last decade, and we now have this much, much higher level of government spending as a share of economic activity, which I agree. I do think that is one reason why the economy has grown closer to 2% as opposed to 3%, which is much more normal.
Yeah. All right, we've got to take a quick break here. We will go on and on. And we will take a quick break. Again, this is a special recording of Money Matters, and we'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is a special edition of Money Matters, and I'm here with just a terrific economist from a great group, and that's First Trust. It's Bob Carey with First Trust. He's our chief marketing strategist. And that's a big title for a guy that just thinks of a big picture, if you will. I think that's the best way to describe First Trust in the first place. And why they have nailed things. And I'm not just here to say, wow, these guys are just great. That doesn't get me anything. But I just, when people are nailing it and most people are not, I just do like to point that out. And these guys have really been nailing it. So, again, hats off to you all and the way you see the markets in a long-term perspective in a very short-focused world, Bob. So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure, Dave. Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that.
I want to dive back into, let's just talk about this. I like to talk about what I've been thinking about, right? And so let's go back, and I'd like your take on this too. Thinking about cyclical industries and secular, not cyclical versus secular, meaning what types of things, and I'm going to relate this to growth versus value. And this let me give you some statistics, and you know them, but for everybody else, right? Growth versus value over the last 5 years. It almost doesn't even matter when you measure last 3 months, last 6 months, last 1 year, last 8.5 years. It doesn't really matter. Growth is crushing value and has for 10 years. And the differential is huge. And people are talking about, well, we should invest in value and things like that. But the answer is the difference is 5% a year. We're getting almost 13% on growth versus 7.5%-ish on value. As we break the S&P in a classic value sense. So the question is this. Many industries are dying because the world is changing so quickly. How do you define growth and value now? And should investors really have been and should be thinking forward in a different way to avoid investing in secular declines or what we used to call value traps?
Yeah, I think the big driver of that differential is that you have this incredible technological revolution that is changing everything. And investors, you know, our thought on valuation and looking at the world from an investment strategy perspective is always looking through the lens of growth, but that growth in relation to what you're paying for that growth. In other words, you can have a wonderful company, it might be growing fast, but if you pay too much for earnings, that is going to be a disappointing investment at some point, because not every company, in fact, most companies can sustain growth rates of only a certain amount for a certain amount of time. And so understanding where a company is at from a life cycle perspective, maybe where an industry is at from a life cycle perspective, those are very important distinctions. And so we've got, on the value side of the market, the biggest driver of the value indexes tends to be cyclical companies and financials. And financials have done reasonably well at times over the last couple of years, but not all that great in comparison to the drivers of the growth side of the market, which is primarily technology and healthcare. Healthcare was, for example, the best sector of the market last year. What's interesting about this year is that for the first time in a while, we have seen in the small cap space, the value side's actually worked pretty well. It's actually slightly ahead of the growth side in the small cap side of the market, but that's a very, very small part of the market. If you look at where most investors have their portfolios allocated, it's on the large cap side of the marketplace. And I suspect that as we go through bouts of volatility, like we saw back in December, like we saw back in May, we do tend to see more volatility in the growth side of the market. Tech was, you know, front and center in terms of sectors that were beaten up back in May. I do think that it makes sense for investors to have something on the value side so that those stocks tend to hold up a little bit better when we have volatility in the market. But, you know, going back to the sectors within Stiles, the energy sector historically has been a very big component of the value side of the marketplace. And back when we had inflation in the 70s and even the inflation that we had for a while in the last decade, that sector did really, really well, and that helped a lot of value managers in that particular space. The stocks tend to sell it closer to their book value, and usually that's the price of a company, the value of a company in relation to its book value, typically is the main distinction between growth and value from an index perspective. So you're looking at potentially lower rates of return businesses that sell at closer to book value on the value side of the market. And investors have gravitated, I think, in the last 5 to 10 years, more so towards companies that are growing their businesses much, much more rapidly. So I think that you know, we have more technology in the economy today than we did 5 years ago, 10 years ago. You think about, you know, you travel, you take Uber, you've got all these different apps that you use to go shopping and travel and conduct business. It's a different world today. So technology has really been a very hot sector, very attractive sector, and these stocks have done really well. And they've done well because these companies have made a lot of money. And I think that's the one difference between this cycle and maybe the 90s. We had investors paying up for tech companies in the 90s that had very, very much unproven business models, whereas today it's very clear that companies like you mentioned, Apple earlier, and Google, these companies have got business models that are very impressive. We've seen, in fact, very, very high rates of return, high growth rates, and shareholder value has been created at a very, very rapid rate. So it's very natural for investors to be attracted to that.
No doubt, no doubt. I let me poke at energy for a minute, because that was one sector that feels to me is literally in secular decline. Now, I don't mean the delivery or the whole industry, but when we look at it from a valuation perspective, and I do have to certainly give credit to your, I'm going to call him the MLP guy. I don't know his name, but he certainly is pretty smart in that area. And
no question.
And talked about the, you know, actually his charts and stuff were just phenomenal. I've shared them with this audience before. where we take the big producers, the Chevron, the Exxon, and run their earnings over the last 10 years versus simple utilities and pipeline companies and things like that. There's no comparison.
Right.
They look like there's I look at it and you go, why would you ever buy Exxon or Chevron, which was a no decision or a one decision stock in the 80s? And that's the king. Those are the kings of that producing energy environment. And they had tailwinds of a rising cost. Okay, so that's the bottom line. How do you see that sector? And that's where these value managers, I'm confused. How come they're underperforming in a market where you're just defining yourself as value, but you're underperforming the value index as well, when you could be adding a little bit of Microsoft and still be value?
Right. And I think it gets back to technology. We have more technology used in the production of oil and gas than mm-hmm. ever before. You know, fracking, it doesn't sound very complicated, but the reality is that where these drilling companies and these exploration companies look and find oil is much more sophisticated than it was 20 years ago. And, you know, the reality is that we are now the world's largest producer of energy. We are now starting to export energy and energy-related products. This has been a big game changer. You know, you think, just taking a step back and looking at the economy with unemployment at below 4%, in the past, we would have had significantly higher levels of inflation than we do today. And I think the main difference between this cycle and previous cycles is that we have essentially the price of oil and gas curtailed because of this huge increase in productivity in the energy sector. And you know, we're not using necessarily less energy. We're using more than we were 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But we're using it more efficiently. We're also getting it to the marketplace more efficiently than we ever have before. So we just don't have these large producers of oil and gas. The raw commodity is in abundance, and there's lots of it. And every time the price begins to rise a little bit, you know, other producers around the world begin to produce more. So effectively, we've put a lid on the price of oil. There was a time back in the early 80s when the energy sector was close to a third of the S&P 500. Today, it's less than 5% of the S&P 500. So the energy story has been going on for a long, long time. But if you look at some of these big companies in that space, they do not generate the rate of return on their balance sheets that they did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So it's at some point, I do expect that credit markets and the rating agencies are going to make it more difficult for some of these marginal producers to basically increase capacity. The Pemex, the big Mexican oil, they largely state-controlled oil company, was just downgraded recently, just last couple of days, by the rating agencies. And at one time, it was effectively the largest oil and gas producer in North America. They cannot get capital at a reasonable rate like they might have gotten 10 years ago. So it tilts the balance towards domestic production, I think, as much as anything. And I think that's had a profound impact on inflation, on the economy, and how we look at things today. We're able to produce things much more effectively than we were 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, another time, but the geopolitical implications are off the charts, too, with the Middle East,
big
Russia,
time,
et cetera. It's just things that are just, we could spend all day talking about. But we got to take a break. So let's take a break here for Fox News.
Very good.
And we will be right back. Hello and welcome back to a special edition of Money Matters. I'm here with Bob Carey, who is with First Trust, and really some big picture thinkers. They spend an enormous, enormous amount of time, money, resources on markets, conditions, and just thinking longer term, not day trading things. And one of the quietest $100 billion plus money managers there is. Probably the quietest. Bob, thank you again for joining us. I've really enjoyed our discussion so far.
Yeah, my pleasure, Dave.
I want to kind of pick up a little bit of, if you will, some of the things that have concerned me and kind of move forward. You talked about inflation not concerned on inflation. I'm not concerned at all. In fact, I think we're in a, if you will, secular non-inflation time because of technology, if you will. And I'm just going to give a quick example and let you run with your thoughts regarding technology and how it's keeping these costs down. But our office, 15 years ago, we branched off from some other folks, and we're now about six times as big, and we have one less admin person. Six times the volume of business and one less admin. That's technology, but you multiply that across every industry. And everything appears to me, other than, you know, travel, of course, is more expensive, and healthcare. But I also feel like healthcare has real possibilities of something breaking through and breaking through our psyche to allow us to have market forces to drive costs down within medical care, like it has for everything else, whether it's energy or what have you. And I just wanted to, if you will, comment on what you all's thinking, not short term on inflation, but is it a different world? I know that's dangerous, but is it different this time?
Yeah, there's no question that healthcare, and I would submit maybe education as well, are two areas where we have not seen these disinflationary forces that we've been talking about. At the same time, those markets, especially for the market for healthcare, is such a large market that it begs for more investment that would in turn, I would have to think, drive down costs over time. And I think we have essentially a very, very large amount of government involvement in that industry that takes away some of the incentive to become more productive in that particular space. I'm keeping a close eye on the number of products that are in clinical trials. And I think that the exciting thing from an investment perspective, of course, is when a company comes up with something new and novel that can treat people in ways that we couldn't have imagined before. And so, right now there are essentially 1,000 products, what we call new molecular entities that are in phase 3 clinical trials. And that the amount of spending on research and development has increased the last couple of years as a percentage of sales after being in decline for about a decade. So, companies in that industry are feeling more confident in spending money on developing these new products and new services. And to me, that's very exciting. At the same time, I do think that a bumper crop of new products to treat a lot of different ailments has the potential to be met with a lot of political scrutiny on the part of regulators and the public. These products that come to market are very expensive, and it takes a lot of money to bring these products to market. And I think that I've noticed increasingly over the last couple of years that companies are disclosing a little bit more information about the costs of these clinical trials. It was almost kind of a given. Companies would spend almost anything on clinical trials if they felt that the product was strong enough or had enough potential. I think companies are getting much better at figuring out early on whether something is a sunk cost or whether it's worth proceeding. And that's, once again, more technology. I think these early clinical trials means that these companies will have more success in getting their products to market. And I think that will reduce, ultimately, the cost of these trials. And that's the biggest cost that companies face is the amount of time and expertise that it takes and resources to get these products to marketplaces. So I think essentially we're starting to see products become much more targeted. The FDA is being, I think it's a much more streamlined bureaucracy than it was 5 years ago for a couple of reasons. But I think in the end, one very significant factor would be if new products did not have the high costs associated with them like we've seen in the past. I think that's going to be a real possibility, I think, in the next 5 to 10 years. And we need that to happen. We have an enormous number of people who are retiring and are about to retire here in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think that getting a handle on those costs is a big challenge. And I think the market forces and technological forces are going to assert themselves like they always do in that space.
Yeah. Now, when we talk about that over the whole economy, if you will, everybody's focusing on wages, and this may draw us back to our initial discussion of the data today rather than long-term knowledge or wisdom. When we're talking about inflation now, everybody focuses on wages or wage growth and things like that, and it's going to be terrible, and the unemployment rate. And we continue to defy that. We've blown out everything we learned in high school and college and so on. It's all gone. And is the force of technology so great that some of these economic forces are being completely bent to its will?
I think that's exactly what's happening. One of the best examples that I can give you is the package delivery business today is much more technological than it was before. The amount of inventory management that is done from an IT perspective is profound. And these companies increasingly are finding ways to deliver packages much more efficiently. One of the best examples I can give you is UPS about 7 or 8 years ago realized that if their drivers predominantly took right-hand turns all day, and essentially their routes were a concentric circle that got smaller and smaller, they would save a tremendous amount of energy and fuel. And they did that and immediately got almost a 10% bump in productivity from you think about how large a company like that is worldwide. There's all these little things that because of we just simply know more. There's more information out there that can be utilized to make things more efficient and more productive. And in the end, inflation is as much a monetary phenomenon as it is about productivity. And we had a lot of policies back in the 60s and especially the 70s that actually drove productivity down, and that's one reason why we had the inflation today. For the most part today, the policies have gone the other way, and we're not discouraging companies from becoming more productive. And I also think, by the way, and I think you hinted at this, I don't think wages capture the amount of compensation that is out there. Increasingly, citizens are finding a way to earn a living in a variety of different ways. I've got a friend of mine who he's a real estate broker, and he sits on a couple of boards for companies, and he's got a consulting job. He's not on anybody's payroll.
He's on off
and
the grid.
And yet he's got three jobs.
Yes.
I think increasingly people are increasing their net worth in a way that is not necessarily showing up in a traditional, I go to work, I punch the clock, and I'm there 9 hours. And it was very well defined maybe a generation or two ago. I think increasingly it's very hard to measure the amount of compensation and the amount of income that people generate.
Well, it's only straight up salary. It's not bonuses or self-employed income. So
exactly.
Like your friend, he's off the grid for measurement.
Yep.
Okay, we got to take our final break real quick, Bob. Hang tough, and we will be right back. Hello and welcome back to this special edition of Money Matters. Once again, I am here with Bob Carey with First Trust. He's their chief marketing strategist, has been with them for 28 years. I'm not going to say any more because I don't want to take up the last of our little bit of time here. Let's toss out some of the big questions again. I want you to deal with this one, okay? And that's the budget deficit. We've got people that are worried about the budget deficit, and they should be. But on top of that, we're $20 trillion, and nobody's dealing with it. And the big questions of all the entitlement programs that are supposedly at $70 billion or $100 billion that were underwater, and Social Security, nobody will talk about it. Nobody's dealing with it. And I'd like to hear what you all are thinking about it. And is it something we should be worried about, or we get to not worry about it for another 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, great question, Dave. I get that question all the time, as I'm sure you do too as well. One of the points that I always make about the budget deficit is that the budget deficit is and has always been financed by our savings and our excess, if you will. And every time the government comes to market to borrow money, and they do that every quarter, typically they're, for every dollar that the federal government is actually needing to borrow because of the deficit, there's typically about $3 or even $4 in bids to buy those securities. And at this point, the budget deficit has, we've easily financed it. It's not really not been a very, very big issue at all. The longer term issues that would cause me to get much more concerned, and I think a lot of folks in Washington who track the budget would be much more concerned, would be if we had an increase in spending above and beyond that 25% of GDP that we talked about earlier, and we had perhaps higher interest rates. I think in the end, credit markets are potentially the one spot that may force some discipline from a budgetary perspective long term. It's, you know, so far that hasn't really been the issue. We continue to see a lot of capital flowing into bond funds and so forth. So financing deficits around the world at the sovereign level has not presented a problem. But at the end of the day, we have a $20 trillion economy. We've got about 170 or so trillion dollars in assets as Americans. If you add up all of our businesses, our real estate, our holdings, that deficit that we have is a relatively small amount in comparison to our assets. That deficit's grown, unquestioned. There's no question about that. But I think that our economy, once again, is a lot more than just what happens at the federal level. We have this enormous private sector that is where everything gets financed anyways. All of our savings comes from that ultimately. So my favorite story about the last couple of years, I'll make this quick, is I had a discussion with somebody about the deficit. They were very worried about it, and that same person told me that 80% of their net worth was in treasuries. And I pointed out to him, I find it ironic that 80% of your net worth is being used to finance the thing that you are most concerned about. And I think ultimately investors need to think some of these things through and figure out a way to stay ahead of it.
It's a very good point. I remember along those lines, John Templeton talking about the super high inflation in the Banana Republic of Brazil years ago, right?
Yep.
He said, would you rather lend money to the grocery store at 25,000% inflation, or would you rather own the store and be able to raise prices?
That's it. That's exactly right.
Bob, we are unfortunately out of time. Thank you so much for your time today. Bob Carey with First Trust. Thanks again.
My
hope
pleasure,
we get to do
Dave.
It again. Yeah.
I hope so too.
Yeah. Good. Come back to Boise sometime soon. We'd love to have you here in God's country.
I would love that. And happy Father's Day to you and all the other dads out there.
Likewise. Have a great rest of the day. And we'll be back live next week. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.